In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby.
All right, let's do it. Let's talk films, movies, cinema. Alan Adams of The Main Edge together. Here for Pass the Popcorn. Happy Monday, sir.
And to you as well.
You had a good weekend?
Yeah, it was nice. It was nice. Got out and about a little bit. You'll be happy to hear this. On Friday, we went in for Stella's quarterly oncology checkup.
Well, I was going to ask about that.
And 100% clear.
Oh, that's great.
Like the doctor actually said, I'd never heard a vet say something, but he's just like, I just really like it when this is the news I get to give.
Oh, that's awesome.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And it was really lovely. And, and so she's doing well. She was pretty furious at all the strangers who were trying to invade her house last night.
Yeah.
But at least she was in good health to do it. So do her job.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Ginger was mostly confused.
Sure.
And she did sneak out a couple of times and greet the little children by either trying to kiss them or blind them with her tail.
Yep, that sounds right.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Stella is convinced that anyone who attempts to ascend her porch is coming to murder us all. doesn't matter how large or small they are, whether they're a princess or what have you. Nope. It's like, oh, that's a murderer, and we cannot be having that.
See, I think Ginger believes that too, but she thinks they're coming for the humans, not her.
Right.
And she wants to get on their good side.
She's like, well, let's see what direction this takes us.
Are you my new owners? All right. Because frankly, I got some beefs with the last bunch. I like you. You smell nice. Sure. Well, here we are. It's Monday. We've got movies to talk about. And since last we chatted, you've seen three of them. And I'm interested in hearing what you think about all three. Where do we begin?
Let's start with Antlers.
Antlers, which I didn't realize until a while back, a week or so ago, was written and produced by friend of the show, Nick Antosca.
Yes, he wrote the short story, I believe, that the script is based on. He's a co-writer on the script alongside the director, Scott Cooper, I believe his name is.
And we've had Nick on a couple times when he did the sci-fi series that now I can't remember the name of, Channel Zero.
Oh, okay. Yes. No, that was mentioned in, I saw that pop up a couple times when I was researching, as I was writing the review. It's interesting. And obviously, like, it's great to have an opportunity to go to see a horror movie, on, you know, Halloween weekend.
Yeah.
Like that's one of the great things to kind of do. Granted, I saw mine, on Saturday morning, not necessarily a big crowd out for the sort of combination of folklore / body horror that Antlers brings to the table. But I didn't know a lot about it going in, and I'll concede that I had fairly low expectations, simply because I didn't have any sort of understanding of where it was coming from. But what I got was a movie that was really, I love it when horror movies strike that balance between the sort of more visceral nature of the genre and the sort of thematic and ideological explorations that you can do within the confines of genre. It's really hard to get that balance right. This movie, it's not perfect, but it gets it closer than a lot do, which made for a really, really compelling sort of viewing experience. So it's set in the Pacific Northwest, a small rural Oregon town, a former mining town where the mine has been shut down. And so you have the the economic and social issues that come with, that sort of employer being shut down. There's a man who has set up a meth lab inside the disused mine. And, he's getting ready to move on. They've done their meth labbing and they're gonna move forward. He's come to sort of do the last of the cleanup. He's brought his young son with him, left him in the car while he went down. And but when he's down there, he hears some pretty mysterious noises, and so he goes down this sort of disused passageway, comes to a doorway that has all these sort of handcrafted leather bags hanging from the ceiling. I see that. I'm done. It's like, right. Okay.
Gotta go.
See ya. But this fellow and his compatriot continue to investigate the mysterious sounds. And, well, you don't see what happens, but you hear some stuff.
Mm.
And then that scene is punctuated by the young boy getting out of the truck, going in and calling for his father.
Oh dear.
Yeah. So we cut to a few weeks later, and that's where we meet a young woman named Julia, played by Carrie Russell. She's a teacher at the elementary school. Recently returned to her hometown after the death by suicide of her estranged father. She's staying with her brother, Paul, played by Jesse Plemons, who is the town sheriff now. They have a very complicated relationship. There's a history of abuse. And that history of abuse has her sort of hyper aware when she notices the odd behaviors of a young man named Lucas. Lucas, who happens to be the son of and older brother of the two who have... and so she sees, she sees some behaviors, some questionable behaviors, questionable actions, and starts to worry about this young man and starts reaching out, like touches base with the principal, tries to go through all the proper channels while also trying to establish a relationship with this young man. Meanwhile, we're watching him and we see a kid behaving in troubling manner. He's picking roadkill up off the road, and it's implied that maybe he's harming or even killing small animals, and you're just it's an unsettling sort of situation. But it becomes clear that there is a reason that the young man is collecting these things when he goes home to an empty, darkened house where with locks on the outside of the attic door. And you hear noises very similar to the ones that his dad heard in the mine.
Oh, dear.
Only they're coming from upstairs in his house.
Front row.
Yep. And I'm stopping there. okay. I don't want to give anything else away. It's alluded to that there is a sort of supernatural aspect to all of this, a legendary beast known as the Wendigo, a shape-shifting creature from Native American folklore. I'll leave the viewers to find out if that's how things play out. It's probably how things play out, but it's one of those things where this is a movie that tries to do a lot. Like, and it is addressing the nature of trauma, both cultural, societal, like economic traumas to a place, and the individual traumas that come from abusive relationships, whether it be from parent to child, or what have you, while also tossing out some pretty gnarly body horror type stuff, like some whenever the term shapeshifter gets introduced into a horror movie, some stuff's gonna get weird.
Yeah,
and this definitely delivers on that. It gets pretty gruesome, pretty gory in some spots. Although most of the gore we see is more aftermath than actual in action, mm-hmm. which I think is almost worse. It's just like you just see what's left and you're like, good God, what could possibly have happened? So that's sort of unsettling. Man, I gotta tell you, like, I was sort of, when I first saw like the opening credits, I'm like, well, this cast is wildly overqualified for this movie. You've got Carrie Russell, who's excellent. Mm. Jesse Plemons, who...
He's great.
Yeah, he's just so good. But then you're talking about a supporting cast that includes wonderful performers like Amy Madigan is in this. Graham Greene is in this. Like, just a great cast. But then you watch the movie and you're like, oh, okay. So these people are really going for it. And I will say the script does tend to focus more thematically than on character specifics. But the truth is, when you have actors this good, they can make that. They can build that sort of dimension, regardless of what's written on the page. And so, I wasn't expecting a lot from Antlers, but man, I gotta say, it was a pretty good movie.
All right, we're talking with Alan Adams of The Main Edge on Downtown. What's up next?
Let's talk about Army of Thieves.
Okay.
So. It's like I'll tell a little bit of story. So my wife and I, Sheridan, we try to watch a lot of these movies together. Like I basically like make my schedule around the movies that we're watching. If she's interested in something, I will watch it when she's available to watch it. If she is not interested, say Antlers, that's when I will head off by myself. So Army of Thieves is the sequel to this summer's Army of the Dead, which was the zombie heist thriller starring mm-hmm. Dave Bautista and a number of other people. So Sheridan hears that and she's like, I'm not really, I'm not here for a zombie movie. I'm like, okay, that makes total sense. So then I start watching the movie and I'm about 20 minutes in and it dawns on me. It's like, oh, so this is, cause it's a prequel. This is a prequel to the zombie heist movie, focusing far more on the latter part of that descriptor than the former. It's a heist movie.
Oh,
you know? And so I'm like, okay, I stopped it. And we went and we sat down and we watched it together. And while it is a prequel and the sort of early sort of burgeoning zombie apocalypse that happens in the subsequent movie is very present. But it's only present on the periphery. It's like news broadcasts, and our main character has a couple of nightmares. But there's no real zombie stuff. It's just kind of a straight up heist movie, and it's a pretty fun one too. The film focuses on the goofy German safecracker character from Army of the Dead. I don't even know how you arrive at that decision. And I want to make sure I get the guy's name right. His name is the actor's name is Matthias Schweighofer.
Of course.
No. Yes. Who also directs this movie.
Oh.
Yeah. Like I was just like I had no idea that it was so like it was such a thing. But yeah, so he's reprising this character, but the character from before he was, you know, the safe cracker who cracked the safe in Army of the Dead. He's just a dude named Sebastian living in Potsdam, working as a bank teller. His hobby is safe cracking and safe cracking history. And so he makes YouTube videos about it that literally no one watches. And then he lives his sort of humdrum life. His particular area of interest is a legendary locksmith by the name of Hans Wagner, who has crafted four supposedly impenetrable safes based on his namesake's ring cycle. So there are all these names. Wow. Yeah. And so he's an expert on this particular guy and his work. And so he receives a mysterious invitation to a safe cracking competition. Rich, there's a scene. I swear to God, it's an underground safe cracking competition where it's just a bunch of like randos, like with safes surrounded by, well-dressed people who are betting on the outcome. It's like Fight Club, only it's safes. and I'm just like, and as soon as I saw that scene, that was when I realized, okay, I need to stop this because Sheridan is going to want to watch this movie right. with me. He wins the competition, spoiler alert, and winds up, through those circumstances, winds up getting recruited into an international band of bank robbers who are planning a 4-day jaunt back and forth across Europe where they are going to attempt to crack not one, not two, but three of the four ring cycle safes.
Woo.
And wouldn't you know it, our friend Sebastian, he's the only guy for the job. And so we're off and we get this wonderful sort of, meet the crew kind of situation. It's led by this international criminal named Gwendolyn, who is played... Gwendolyn, and then you've got the hacker, and you've got the getaway driver, and you've got a character. I love this guy. He's a wannabe action hero type who has changed his name to Brad Cage for Brad Pitt
yes.
and Nicolas Cage.
Right.
And so this team comes together, and they're jetting back and forth to crack these safes, and all the while we're getting these little... nods to various sort of heist movie tropes, but they're being addressed very directly. And so like with a little wink to the audience. So it's a very self-aware movie. The heists themselves are super fun. Our man Matthias, a very good actor, Clearly a very good director too, because he really captures the sort of screwball energy that the best heist movies have, the best comic heist movies have, where you really sort of get swept up into the action and don't ask a whole lot of questions, because once you start doing that, pretty much any heist movie is going to come apart if you start pulling at the threads. But they do a really good job of not really giving you time to do that. And all the characters are engaging in such a wonderful way. I heard this idea. I'm like, wait, so you're gonna make a sequel about the safecracker from the zombie movie? Like, why would you even do that? It turns out because the result is a pretty entertaining movie.
Very nice. All right. Well, I look forward to that. And finally, the newest from Edgar Wright, Last Night in Soho.
Man, you know, there are relatively few filmmakers out there where you can sit down and watch for 5 minutes and be like, oh, I know who this is. The Coen brothers, either Anderson, Paul Thomas or yep. Wes Anderson. And Edgar Wright is very much in that category. Like there's a very distinct style, both visually and otherwise, to his work that is it's very much of a piece. Like it's his work. It's his style. You can't no one else can do what he does. So I was very curious because I've been hearing it. We've been hearing about a lot of movies that are coming out now. We've been hearing about for a very long time just due to the delays caused by the pandemic. So his latest is Last Night in Soho, which is the closest thing to a horror movie that I think I suppose Shaun of the Dead would be classified as a horror movie, kind of like the. We'll say like thriller. This is a straight up like psychological thriller in a way that we haven't really seen from him before. But it's tackled with all the same sort of stylistic ideology that he brings to the table. You've got time travel. You've got this wonderful identity swap kind of situation, and a frankly rather unsettling final act. As my wife put it, she's like, I loved this movie. And then it got kind of stabby. But anyway, so we're following a young woman named Ellie, played by Thomasin McKenzie, who's great in this movie. She's an aspiring fashion designer who's obsessed with the sounds and style of the 1960s. Like that's where she draws her inspiration. She's just been accepted into a very prestigious London fashion program. Her grandmother is troubled by her going away, not just because she's sort of a small town girl, but because she's still dealing with feelings from her mother's passing. She wants what's best for her granddaughter, so off to the big city she goes, where she immediately finds herself really struggling to fit in. Like her roommate is a snobby girl named Jocasta immediately hates her, and so she's left to struggle her way through dealing with a roommate who hates her. She can't really make friends. She gets bullied a little bit. Finally, she just says, "To heck with it! I can't do this anymore," and decides she's gonna go rent a room. She's gonna move out of the dorms and she's gonna rent a room. And so she rents a room in the house of a woman, Ms. Collins, played by Diana Rigg.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah, it's Diana Rigg.
Wow.
I'm like, what? What's going on? Anyway, a little prudish, got some pretty specific rules about how things are in her house. But Ellie leaps at the chance, loves it, and moves into her new room. That night, she has an incredibly vivid dream where she is transported back to the London of the mid to late 1960s. It's all flashing neon and, nightclubs and all this stuff. And she's just wandering through this world that feels very, very real to her. She winds up making her way into a club, where she, catches a glimpse of herself, in the mirror, and she's not herself.
Mm.
The reflection she sees turns out to be, a woman named Sandy, played by Anya Taylor-Joy, who is an aspiring nightclub singer. And so she's...
And there's a killer version of Downtown,
yes.
by the way.
Yeah. Oh, man, we'll get to the music, because Edgar Wright knows how to drop a needle.
Yeah.
So she's an aspiring nightclub singer and winds up hooking up with an erstwhile manager named Jack, played by Matt Smith, one of the Doctor Whos. I don't remember which one he is, but... And so there's this, you know, there's dancing and singing, and it's like this beautiful swinging 60s vibe. And she wakes up and she's reinvigorated. Ellie's like, oh, I'm going to, you know, and she starts, you know, bringing that the sort of fashions and things that she saw that night, like to her work at school. And she's, you know, getting noticed for it and all these things. And every night when she goes to sleep, she's back in that place. She's back in that world. But it quickly becomes a little less exciting and a little more frightening as the relationship between Jack and Sandy becomes more fraught. And it turns out that Jack's claims of being a manager were technically true, but not necessarily a manager of singers. I'm not going to be specific because I don't want to reveal too much. But suffice it to say, their relationship has entered into a place that is unexpected and frankly, a bit unpleasant in a lot of ways. And every time Ellie goes back to sleep, she winds up back in this place and things become more and more fraught as she's going through. And as you can probably hear, I'm talking in circles a little bit because I do not want to spoil this, because there is a lot that happens in this movie that is surprising. There are some twists, some that are telegraphed and you see coming, others that are basically masked by the telegraphed ones, and it's just like, oh, Edgar Wright, you son of a gun, you are you know exactly what you're doing. You know, and we meet some other folks in Ellie's life. There's a classmate who's, you know, supportive of her. We also have a turn, he never gets named, but they just bill him as Silver-Haired Gentleman. But Terrence Stamp is around being all creepy.
Whoa.
And it's just there's just a lot going on in this movie. And plot-wise, that's where we're going to stop, because things take a pretty significant turn in the back half of the film. I did mention the stabbiness. That's a little spoilery, but I think that's okay. I feel like there's some stabbing in the trailer, so people probably know that it's coming. I love Edgar Wright. Like, I love his style. I love his gift of visual imagery. Like, no one crafts a screen picture quite like he does. And then you introduce the element of the music, which we were talking about a second ago. The soundtrack of this movie is so good. And the soundtrack of all of his movies are excellent, but like it's incorporated, so beautifully, in this film. You mentioned, Anya Taylor-Joy singing Downtown, which is a wonderful moment. I'm not going to go through all these awesome needle drops because there are a ton of them. But I will say there's a moment when, let me make sure I get it right here. It's the original version of Got My Mind Set on You, the James Ray version.
Yeah.
As opposed to the one,
not the George Harris,
which either. Everyone knows. And I was like, I'm sitting there and I'm like, I'm not sure I've ever heard this version of the song before, because Harrison's was so ubiquitous. But there are a number of moments like that where we get sort of different versions of songs that you are very familiar with, but versions that are very much of the time in which they're being sung or played or whatnot. Mm-hmm. And so it's just this wonderful layer of verisimilitude that is just, it's the kind of thing that only a super like nerd would really, you know, really invest themselves in. But like Wright is clearly that guy. Like he's so much a product of the pop culture that he loves, that he's consumed. You know, all you have to do is look at like the Cornetto trilogy, you know, Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz and The World's End to understand that is the kind of storyteller that he is. He is someone who is unafraid to really dig into his influences. I feel like his later work has gotten away from the sort of almost pastiche, homage-y type stuff into more original storytelling. But the truth is, it's like, man, I don't know if there's like there's no one quite like Edgar Wright out there. You know, I'm a firm believer in auteurs, as far as filmmakers go. Like, I love it when there is a singular vision, as long as that singular vision, is strong enough to support the movie around it. Edgar Wright is that guy, as are so many of these other ones. But yeah, the performances are phenomenal. Mackenzie is someone who I think we're going to be hearing a lot from. Anya Taylor-Joy, obviously, is just absolutely incandescent right now. Like, she is so talented. You know, Matt Smith gives good dirtbag. Terrence Stamp. And again, Diana Rigg, who is legitimately excellent in this movie in a number of different ways, some of which could probably be deemed spoilery. So I'm not going to go into it too far, but just know that she is fantastic, as are, you know, the cast across the board is outstanding, and they are operating in what is just a beautifully realized world. And I had an absolute blast at last night. So
I think Baby Driver is one of the best movies of the last
decade.
It's
so good, you know, and it's just like, and again, it's indicative of his ability to blend the visual and the audio in a way that just no one else does.
Awesome. I can't wait to see it. Thanks, Al.
My pleasure.
Alan Adams, Main Edge, talking movies on Downtown.